You know, a minister gets some interesting phone calls during the day. Last Monday, a man from Gloucester County called. He had read the article in the newspaper that Preston and I wrote, and he wanted to talk to the minister. He's Baptist, he told me, a devout Christian from the age of 6. And he had heard a little bit about Unitarians, and he wanted to know something more. He wanted to know what UU thought about God, about worship, about salvation. We talked for about a half an hour, and at the end of the conversation, he asked, quietly, "What do you think happens to us after we die?" "I don't know," I said. "I don't know. All I know is that right now, I'm talking with a man who's asking sincere questions. All I know is that as soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm going to get ready for a meeting with the board president. And in every action and interaction I have during the day, I try to praise the life that I've been given. And then I get up the next day and I try to do it again." I think he was disappointed with my answer. He may have been looking for something a little more solid. People seem to want simple answers to complex questions. What will happen to me after I die? How does my death fit into the larger story of humanity? What does my individual life, what part does my individual life play in the larger human story? The book of Revelation in the Christian Bible gives an answer to those questions that many people find compelling and seductive. So it's not surprising that it has inspired one of the most popular fiction series of all time, with each of its 12 titles making the New York Times bestseller list. Co-authors Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins have sold more than 62,000 copies of the Left Behind books. And now, Left Behind is a video game coming to a store near you just in time for Christmas. It's targeted toward 13-year-old boys in particular, and here is its premise. You are a foot soldier in a paramilitary group. You are armed with high-tech military weaponry, and your mission is to conduct physical and spiritual warfare to remake America a Christian theocracy. Yeah, for 13-year-old boys. The Left Behind Enterprise is concerned with the end times, the last things, the completion of human history, what theologians call eschatology. They base their stories on one particular interpretation of the book of Revelation, and that interpretation is actually quite modern. It originated with a group of conservative Christians in the 19th century. They were reacting to the rise of rationalism and liberalism in the American Protestant denominations, conspicuously led by Unitarians and Universalists. The name of this new conservative movement was fundamentalism. At its core lies the belief that the second coming of Jesus is imminent, and that the book of Revelation, as well as other books of the Bible, read literally, contained veiled messages that would predict the final unfolding of human history. According to fundamentalists, these messages reveal that human history can be divided up into 7 periods, or dispensations, starting with Adam and Eve. We are currently in the 6th dispensation, the 6th age, which is marked by moral decline and a vast number of unbelievers. Any day now, without warning, a cataclysmic event called the rapture will occur, during which all true believing Christians will be suddenly taken up. At the rapture, true believers will meet Jesus up in heaven, where they will wait together for 7 years. Meanwhile, back on Earth, the non-believers will be down here suffering the great tribulation. They will be living under the rule of the Antichrist in a system of one world government. At the end of those 7 years, Jesus will return to earth with his army now of faithful believers to battle the Antichrist in a holy war called Armageddon. After winning that battle, Jesus will restore the earth to full health and will reign over the kingdom with Jerusalem as its capital for the next 1,000 years. This will be the seventh and final era in history. At the end of those 1,000 years, the last judgment will take place. And at that time, individual people will be sent to either heaven or hell for an eternity. The last judgment will be the final event in human history. The fundamentalist reading of the book of Revelation gives people a clear answer about what will happen to them after they die. It also assures them that their life and their death are part of the greatest story ever told, and they are not just a speck of cosmic dust. What a story this is. It is a fantastic story, the one told in Revelation. It is full of story and myth, and even its bizarre images have sparked some biblical scholars in the 1960s to wonder if the author of Revelation knew something about psychedelic drugs. It has inspired writers and artists, like the one who created that sculpture pictured on the front of your order of service. Believers in every generation have tried to match up apocalyptic symbols like 666 with prevailing geopolitical events, each naming the Antichrist of their time. And today, with the recent violence between Israel and Palestine and the war in Iraq continuing, it seems, without end, and a war on terrorism that has made the world feel less safe, this end times fascination has spread beyond its fundamentalist base. A recent CNN Times poll reveals that 59% of Americans believe the biblical prophecies about the end of times. And one-third say they are actually paying more attention to how the news relates to end times prophecies. Now, usually when I hear news like this, I just shake my head and say Thomas Jefferson's famous words, "It does me no injury if my neighbor says there are 20 gods or one god or that the end is coming tomorrow. It neither picks my pockets nor breaks my leg." But this time, I have to respectfully disagree with Mr. Jefferson and say that it does matter. It does matter when people with this particular worldview seek out positions of authority and influence in order to shape public policy. Because this worldview and this particular interpretation of the book of Revelation promotes intolerance, violence, and destruction of the earth. The end times worldview cannot tolerate those who disagree. Elaine Pagels, a Princeton theologian, explains that when a society has very simplistic good versus evil worldviews, then every conflict between us and them turns into a moral conflict. So then, we are God's people, and they are Satan's people, and we can do anything to them we want to, without ethical restraint, because God is on our side, and all tactics are fair when fighting the devil. The apocalyptic worldview also promotes war. It promotes it as necessary, and it even promotes it as desirable. Now, if you've ever read the book of Revelation, how many people have read the book? All right, a good number of you. You'll remember that images of warfare and violence are all throughout its pages, The sea becomes blood. There are lakes of fire. There are divine warriors and heavenly armies. The problem is that the booksellers and video game makers aren't the only ones using this imagery to liven up their products. Our political leaders use this language. Phrases like American mission and divine appointment to rid the world of evil, to justify war, and to support the spread of American empire. The end times fascination also leads to apathy about the current needs of the earth and its people. It says, if the world will soon be destroyed anyway, there is no need to take care of the earth. If Jesus is coming back to restore the earth to full health, then why be concerned with global warming, deforestation, the death of coral reefs? The end times mentality breeds a culture of resignation and disengagement with the world's needs. If people only expect the progress of evil, then they will not work for social justice. If people expect only the destruction of the planet, they will not care about the environment. If people hope for only their impending departure, they will not work for the well-being of their neighbor. The end times theology is destructive. And it is a destructive, irresponsible reading of the Bible. The Bible, I believe, is a creation of humans, and as such, contains both blessings and curses. We must read it with our capacity for reason, lifting up those things that support a more abundant life and rejecting those things that make life small and frightening. Here's what I have come to understand about the book of Revelation. First, most biblical scholars now view the book of Revelation as a commentary on the Roman Empire, about the empire's domination of the world and its persecution of the early church. The book of Revelation does not predict the future. It only describes what was happening to a small band of Jesus followers in the second century in Asia Minor. It reveals the thinking of the author, most likely a man named John, a passionate follower of Jesus. John was exiled to the island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea. A relatively mild punishment at that time, actually, for had he been alive during his grandfather's age, during the time of Nero, he would have definitely been sent to the lions. But this was the enlightened second century, when the Roman Empire was ruled by the so-called five good emperors. Even so, it was dangerous, and it was a dangerous time for Jesus' followers, since there was a law that said all non-Israelites had to worship the emperor as a god. In the land that is now Western Turkey, seven fledgling churches quietly functioned. At that time, the economy was booming, and life was pretty comfortable for everyone involved in those early churches. From his island exile, John watched them from afar, watched them become attached to the bounties of the Roman Empire. He watched them become deaf to the cries of enslaved people. He watched them grow complacent about the poor who had lost all their land because they could not pay the emperor's exorbitant taxes. He watched them move away from the essential teachings of Jesus and toward worship of the emperor himself. Where Jesus taught nonviolence, Rome taught war. Where Jesus taught egalitarianism, Rome taught class stratification. Where Jesus taught the gifts of the Spirit, Rome taught the spoils of conquest. Witnessing the people's complacency about the empire's economic exploitation and violent practices, John became angry and frustrated. People were so wrapped up in their comfort, and he knew he had to do something, something extraordinary to get their attention. And that's why he wrote an apocalypse. An apocalypse was an ancient literary genre, one used by the Jews and early Christians. John used this particular form because he knew his audience. He knew that they would not be moved out of complacency by a simple letter or a poem or a song. He used frightening and fantastic images to chastise and alarm his audience. He wanted them to choose. He wanted them to choose God over the emperor, a life of service to the afflicted over a life of material comfort, a life of spirit over a life of possessions, passion for peace over lust for war. But he knew he was asking them to step up to possible persecution and hardship. He knew he was asking them to put their lives at risk, and so he promised them glorious future rewards. He gave them a way to make meaning of their mortal death by making it part of an eternal life. Now, Protestant fundamentalism isn't the only faith that looks way out into the future for the great end. Religious liberalism has its own version of the great end, and it too is set in a chronological future. Look at the two hymns that we sang, or we're going to sing today, this morning. They both hail a future vision. And you'll find them in a section of our hymnal called In Time to Come. We human beings want our individual lives to be part of some greater cosmic meaning. And for that, we have looked into the glorious future. But unlike the end-timers, left-behinders, our version of the time to come does not include violent acts by a wrathful God. No, our golden city will be built by our own hands, by our own will. It's what Unitarian minister James Freeman Clark in 1886 called the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. Religious liberals, especially in the late 19th century, had a profound sense of hope for the future. But then came World War I, the war to end all wars. And then came World War II, and the Holocaust, and Hiroshima, and Vietnam, and the World Trade Centers, and Abu Ghraib. We have seen the limits of human progress, and we have seen the persistence of human evil. We have seen too much, and our eyes can no longer be closed. We can no longer rely on hard work and determination to save us, because it may not. So where do we find hope? How will we be saved from a life that has no meaning? I believe that we find the most meaningful life when we stop gazing outward to the future and start gazing downward into the present. Here, we find that world that is always ending and always being born. Love arises and fades away. The end is always with us, and so is life. As human beings, we are co-creators of that life, and if we are able to connect to that holy truth, we are able to see the world as the poet sees it. In Thornton Wilder's play, Our Town, a young woman dies at childbirth, and she is allowed to relive just one day of her life. As she does so, she is struck by the beauty of the ordinary. Clocks ticking, freshly ironed dresses, hot baths, food and coffee, going to sleep, waking up. "Oh, Earth," she exclaims, "you are too wonderful for anyone to realize you. Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it?" The narrator in the play says, "No. No. The saints and poets, maybe." Czesław Miłosz, the Polish poet, is one such person. In this morning's reading, he gives us images of an ordinary life on the day the world ends. The final line of the poem consists of these startling words, "Warsaw, 1944. Warsaw in 1944 was the site of one of the most tragic events in World War II. For 63 days in the autumn of 1944, the people of Warsaw fought against the Germans who had occupied them. By the end, 65,000 residents had been executed. 55,000 civilians were in concentration camps. 150,000 were transported to labor camps in Germany, and every last civilian was forced to leave the city. Then, German soldiers began a systematic looting campaign, stripping every house of furniture and personal belongings. Afterwards, these empty houses were set on fire. Monuments were destroyed, government buildings blown up. And yet, even in the midst of this unbelievable devastation, Miłosz was able to feel joy. He was able to make a transformative connection with the infinite. Lifted out of his finite misery, he was able to see the miraculous creation all around him, seeing the beauty in the simple act of binding his tomatoes. He says to himself, "There will be no other end of the world. There will be no greater purpose in life. There will be no grander end than to tend to these tomatoes, to notice the bee circling the flower, and to hear the voice of the violin." Does any human being ever realize life while they live it? Is the narrator in our town right that only the poets and the saints can transform the way they see the world? Ours is a faith that dares to proclaim that this transformation is available to everyone. It is not limited to the first 144,000 customers. It is not limited to only those who profess a certain creed. It is available to each and every one of us at every moment of life. The end of the human story is present in the here and now. So realize your life now. Love deeply. Take care of the earth. And if tomorrow comes, then do it again. May it be so. Amen.